Well, that's a first. I stand up and everybody quits talking. That doesn't usually happen. Hope you had a good night's rest. And you're ready to start the marathon that we have on Saturdays. I thought I would ask the audience if there's anything that they had that needed to be announced to the group or anything that you had on your mind. Okay. I'm sitting, standing up here looking at the stuff that Chuck has put on, and it looks, you know, very interesting. He's got a lot to talk about. I met Chuck for the first time this summer after I had contacted him about coming and speaking on the conference, and it was just really, really great to meet him after all these years of knowing that he'd written the book that I think has been, you know, essential for a lot of people in coming out of the church, and was very anxious to have him come and speak to us. He spoke to us when we were just kind of a fledgling organization and we're having the conferences, and I believe it was Vegas that you spoke, right? I think it was the first or second year we got together. So people have been bugging me all these years since to get you on the agenda again. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce Charles Larson.
Well, thank you. I honestly didn't expect to be here at this time last year. You know, sitting here last night listening to the testimonies of so many of you was so familiar, because every different experience is so similar, isn't it? The things that people go through, the types of betrayal that they feel, the anxiety that they have over their families, and then the one theme, though, that gave me the most encouragement was everyone's sense of liberty, the freedom that they have. And that freedom has taken many of us in different directions. Some of us have found other relationships with God. Others have found peace with the secular world. Others have become more tolerant of everyone else around them. Wherever it has taken them, they've gotten there because they've empowered themselves and given themselves the freedom to be able to think and to own themselves. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that. So, yes.
We don't have one of those fancy stands that
goes up and down. Oh. Would you like me to use the wireless mic?
Okay.
Do I have to turn it up like that, or?
No, you speak up.
Flip the switch, turn it on. Is that working? Okay. Do we get feedback from this one too, or? Now, is that too much of an echo? Since my baby left me, I found a new place to... Well, at any rate, we'll leave that there. Since so many of you told about yourselves and your own experiences the other evening, I guess I should start by telling a little bit about mine. I, of course, was a convert to the LDS Church. I was raised outside in the real world, where most of you find yourselves now. As a young man entering the Army, I was exposed to a lot of uncertainty. This was 1969, as you can imagine. Most of us had no idea where we would be a few months from then. And one of the things that I found was this fantastic young man that was in the bunk above me, that didn't smoke, didn't drink, didn't carouse, and he was just seemed to have his head all together. Turned out he'd been a Mormon for a year, and he was just on fire, and he could hardly wait to make more Mormons. Not in the gay way, but... So I began attending church services with him, and I was given the Book of Mormon, told to read it, so I read it, and boy, the next thing you know, I was being baptized, and I'd become a Mormon, and my parents thought, what on earth have you done that for? But I became a Mormon, and a good Mormon. I committed myself to it. I believed it. And it seems like every 2 or 3 months I learned something else that I hadn't known to begin with, things like that they believed that God had been a man once, and, you know, I won't even touch polygamy or any of that other stuff, but But since I'd already made my commitment, I'd already been baptized, I just accepted whatever else they fed me as it went, and then I grew as a Mormon. Okay, fast forward a few years, moved to Utah, met my wife, married in the temple, raising a family, so on and so forth. I'd left BYU to work and raise my family, and then a few years later went back to finish up a degree. I would take history classes and anthropology classes, and I was fascinated by paleoanthropology and archaeology. I would study Mesoamerican culture and the Aztecs, the Olmecs, the Mayans, and their architecture. And then I would go over to the Joseph Smith building and take a religion class, and then I'd see those same buildings that I knew were 14th century Aztec buildings, you know, being displayed all over the Joseph Smith building to give people a testimony about the Book of Mormon, and I thought that was a little bit weird. But... Well, over a series of experiences, I began to find that my relationship with the LDS Church was not really what I wanted it to be. I found myself depending so much upon my priesthood and my ordinances and everything else that my own relationship with God as a Mormon was suffering. I was having more of a relationship with the priesthood and with the organization than I was with my Creator. Well, of course, as a young convert, I wanted to be an apologist. And so every time I'd come across a controversy, I would read everything that everyone had written about it. Hugh Nibley was one of my favorites. John A. Widsoe was one of my favorites. All of the, you know, the myth makers and what have you. All of these things. And every time that I found some problem, they would always go and help me rationalize it. And most of you have had that same type of experience. As a convert, you're taught that the Mormon Church is this huge, wonderful, shining, pure, perfect pillar of truth rising up out of a sea of confusion around it, right? Sound familiar? Well, the problems I would encounter, things like the Adam God doctrine, things like problems with the Book of Mormon and all, they'd be like a brick or a block that had come disjointed from that pillar of truth and got shot clear off into orbit somewhere. But the apologists would always help me build a bridge of rationalization back to that pillar of truth so that it could at least be connected. And as long as I could connect each little discordant block to that pillar of truth, I was fine for years and years. Until finally, and I'm really not sure what provoked it, but finally, I stepped back a little bit and I looked at that pillar of truth with all of those bridges of rationalization connecting all of those loose blocks all over the place, and it looked like a Rube Goldberg structure. It was not this perfect pillar of truth that I had once envisioned it as being and that I'd been taught that it had to be. So at that point, I did something that almost all of the rest of you have done. I gave myself the right to ask questions. And until I had done that, I couldn't claim that right. Once I began asking questions, then so many things began to confuse me. And this was back in the early days, folks. This was the late 70s, and there was no organization. There were no support groups. I had no idea that anyone else had ever questioned the church from inside before. And so I was scared to death. I had this young family. I had two beautiful children. Is that working? Yeah. I had two beautiful children, and I was afraid of losing them. I was afraid of losing my soul. I was afraid of, you know, like that witch in the Wizard of Oz of melting. Whatever was going to happen to me, I didn't know. So I did the unthinkable. I called a Baptist minister from Provo. Called a Baptist minister and said, I'm a young Mormon, and I'm having some questions. Do you know if there's anything that has ever challenged the credibility of the Mormon Church that I could read? I was very naive. Well, I had to be to become a convert, right? I was very naive. So he invited me over, and we talked a little bit, and he took out this plastic-covered phone book,
called Mormonism, Shadow or Reality, 1972 edition, with the very tiny print in double columns and so forth. And he said, well, I'm going to give this to you. And I thought, wow, okay. So I opened it up and I began reading and I became hypnotized. Okay. Where's Sandra? Sandra, darling. God bless you and Gerald, Sandra. You know, if anybody here has found any of my writing of value to them, don't thank me. Thank that lady and her husband. Okay. So I took that book, Shadow or Reality, and I took it to work with me, where I worked at the time at the state prison. And I read that book in 6 days, cover to cover. And then I rested on the seventh. Okay. About halfway through that week, I realized that I had found the answers that I wanted, and I was just hungry to devour more. I was so hungry to devour more. But then, of course, I had my family. I had my wife, who was fifth-generation Mormon on both sides of her family. And I married her largely, well, for a couple of reasons, but largely because she was a valiant Mormon, and I wanted to be thoroughly into this. Well, now I had a big problem. I kept this to myself for a while, but after I'd read Shadow or Reality, I had to tell her. So we went for a drive, and we drove through Spanish Fork Canyon and down past Thistle and, you know, into the San Pete Valley, and we drove on down to Manti, where we were married, because I'd seen a picture of the side of it and thought it was cool, so I wanted to be married there. So we drove down to Manti. We sat on the lawn outside the temple on the Temple Hill, and I told her that I didn't believe that Joseph Smith was really a prophet and that the Book of Mormon wasn't really true. And had the most interesting and heartbreaking ride back home, you can imagine. Well, most of you, of course, can imagine that. So she cried for 3 or 4 days, and then she called the bishop, and the bishop immediately dispatched a couple of 70s over to our house. Now, this was at a time when the 70s were like ward missionaries, okay? Tells you a little bit about the time period. The 70s came over. There was an older fellow that had been in the ward, raised and bred there, and the only time he'd ever left had been to go on his mission, and then he came right back as soon as he could. You know, so he had no exposure to the world. I couldn't relate to him. And then there was a young fellow about my own age. Yes, I was young once. And he had been a convert from Catholicism, and he was just on fire and very into doctrine and very much like I would have been. So I got to walk around the block and talk with him while the other fellow stayed and you know, commiserated with my wife, and they prayed for us, right? Well, this fellow would walk around the block, and I explained to him what my feelings were and why I felt the way that I did, and he told me that I was very perceptive to realize that there was a problem with the church today, because there were certain keys that the church was entitled to hold that it had forfeited, and that others were holding those keys, and when the church repented, that those keys would be restored to the church in due time. I think you know what I'm talking about. This guy was a closet fundamentalist, okay? He was eyeballing and hustling every high school girl in the ward, and he was traveling up to Salt Lake City on the weekends to meet with the all-red group, with the what I later learned was the AUB. And so he told me that, you know, he could go ahead and teach me some things that I needed to know that could straighten me out. Well, I told him that was all fine and good, you know, that if there were problems with the church today, it may not be because it went astray somewhere along the line, but that maybe there were problems with the church from the beginning. And rather than start at the present and work backwards to try to figure out where it went wrong, I'd like to look at the beginning and try to figure out where it went right. Or where it went wrong, or if everything else was wrong from it, then why waste the time getting into some other group? Well, he was very sad to hear that, but he gave me a book to read by B. Harvey Allred called A Leaf in Review. Now, B. Harvey Allred was the founder of the whole Allred clan, which later became the Apostolic United Brethren, which, you know, had split into a couple of different groups in the 1940s. And then, of course, you had Irvel LeBaron. Well, we won't get into that. But anyway, I took that book home, and I did read it, and it was quite interesting, and it started a very long fascination with fundamentalists that I'll get into later. But I showed it to my wife, and I told her what this fellow had tried to go and bring me into. Have most of you discovered that almost every Latter-day Saint has a special button that if you push it, it triggers a response? Okay. I mean, so many other things might go completely over their head, or they'll shrug it off their back, but you push that one button. Well, polygamy was the button for my wife. Okay. She decided right then and there that if the bishop didn't have enough personal revelation on her behalf than to send a closet polygamist into our house to try to convert me, that she had the right to ask questions too. So I gave her Shadow or Reality, and she took 6 months to read it. Okay, 6 months. And she again, a lot of crying all the way through it and so forth, but about halfway through the book, she realized that it really wasn't true, that there really, you know, her whole entire family for generations had been deceived by something. And so she devoured the book as well. Well, once all of this was done, I decided that I had to do the right thing. I didn't sneak into the Mormon church, and I wasn't going to sneak out of it. So this was 1980. You weren't allowed to resign then. You had to be excommunicated if you were going to have your name out of the church. So I went to the bishop, and I told him, I wrote a little letter, and I gave it to him. And the letter said that I wanted to request that a court be held and that I be permitted to have my name removed from the rolls of the church because I no longer had any supporting belief in either the scriptures or the organization or the doctrines that were exclusive to the LDS Church. And I thought that was a beautiful way to put it. And, of course, he blanched and turned white and called the stake president. So I had to go on and take an interview with the stake president. And he, of course, bore his testimony about all the warm, fuzzy experiences that he had and so forth. But I was adamant. And so they held the court. I remember that very well. Have any of you ever attended an excommunication court? All right. God bless you. All right. Well, many people haven't, and not too many people do anymore, but it was an experience I wouldn't have missed. I remember putting on my suit and showing up early, standing there in this new stake building that they had, and a couple of other people drifted in, and we stood around talking for a few minutes, and finally one of them said, "Well, I wonder if this Larson fellow is going to show up or not." And they thought I was another member of the High Council, that they just hadn't met or something. So I said, "Well, I'm the guest of honor. I'm Charles Larson." So they were a little surprised. We went in, and let's see, I'm trying to remember here. I think that there were like 18 people there. There was the stake president and his counselor. There was the bishop, and there was the ward clerk. And then there were 12 high councilmen. Six of them were to represent justice. Six of them were to represent mercy. And the first six and the second six had no idea what they were supposed to do because I wasn't being accused of anything. I was bringing a charge myself. So, well, we for about an hour and a half, these gentlemen all in turns went around and they first of all listened to my request, and then they went around in turns bearing their testimony, telling about how their ancestors had pulled hand carts across the Atlantic Ocean. And finally, one old fellow near the end, with tears in his eyes, looked at me and asked me if I would just read the Book of Mormon one more time and pray about it. And I remember sitting there with an expression on my face much like I have right now. And I looked up at him and made eye contact with the others, and I said, "No, I just finished reading the Book of Mormon again, and every page of it screamed fraud. But I will do this, I said. I said, I will delay my request. I will read the Book of Mormon again if each of you will read a book that I give you. I had no takers. So I stepped out of the room. They deliberated for about 15 minutes. I was invited back in and told that I was no longer permitted to wear garments, they would no longer accept my tithe, and that they encouraged me to attend my meetings and in time repent. And I thanked them, told them that I felt liberated, and that was that. So, well, I still live in the same neighborhood, still know the same people, and for a long time they wondered if I was going to have this pile of whiskey bottles growing outside my bedroom window and motorcycle gangs camped on my front yard and all of the other things. When none of that happened, when I mowed my lawn and kept my garden up and out-Mormoned the Mormons, they just pretty much lost interest and left us alone. It was a little hard for our children, though. Our children, it's hard enough being a non-Mormon in Utah Valley when you're a kid going to school, and it's even harder being a non-Mormon whose parents are apostates, especially apostates who write books. Okay, well, that comes later. Into the book. One of the things that my wife and I wanted to do was to, of course, speak with her family and let them know what was going on and why we had made the decision that we had. We had this incredible need to explain why we had done this, partly out of love for our friends and family and partly just because we knew something they didn't know. So finally, after a few years of rather fruitless results, I decided that perhaps it was time that I took the bull by the horns and identified some aspect of Mormon fallacy that I could specialize in and try to explain to other people. I chose the Book of Abraham, Pearl of Great Price. That was one of the sections of Shadow or Reality that had impressed me the most. Well, it's hard to really pick one that impresses you the most, but that was one that really, to me, seemed like a blueprint for proving that Joseph Smith was a fraud. The evidence was right there. It was just beautifully laid out. The trouble is that so many people had made a mishmash of it. There was a fellow named D.J. Nelson that had gone around and lost his credibility, and there wasn't really anyone else that had come up on it. So I decided I would have to research that and become an expert on it. So, for what it's worth, I don't know what an expert is. They tell me X is a has-been and spurt is a drip under pressure. But I studied it. I won't try to pretend that I learned Egyptian, but I learned enough about it to be able to understand what I was looking at and to be able to comprehend and evaluate what other people were saying about it, which brings us to Hugh Nibley. Well, we won't go there right now. So I began writing and laying out the theme for By His Own Hand Upon Papyrus. And incredibly, how many of you here are writers? I know that we have a number. Okay, wonderful, wonderful. You know that when you write something, you don't just sit down and wait to find out what's going to happen. You have to have a theme. You have to have a purpose. You have to know where you're going. This book, By His Own Hand Upon Papyrus, the entire theme and layout of it, the way that it would be presented, it developed within just a matter of moments in my mind. I could see how the book needed to be written, what it had to do, and then it was just a matter of getting it down on paper before I forgot about it and putting the work into it and then filling in the research that I needed to be able to do it. So I began writing By His Own Hand Upon Papyrus in 1981. It was meant to be about a 50-page pamphlet. Turned out a little more complex than that. I was fascinated by the papyri. There were a series of photographs that were taken of it. I remember reading in the Improvement Era of 1968. They had some rather bad reproductions of the photographs there, but I knew that there were originals. no one had seemed to be able to get a hold of those. So living in Utah Valley, I went over to BYU, and I went into the special collections room, and I filled out a little form, and I asked to go and see the photographs. And they brought me a box about half the size of a shoebox, you know, a little bit wider. And I opened it up, and here were full-color 8x10 prints, beautiful quality of all of the papyri fragments that they'd recovered from the Metropolitan Museum, along with the original 4x5 negatives. No, I didn't steal them. I admired them, made some notes, and then went up to the desk and said, I'd like to have some prints of these made, please. Certainly. When would you like them? Well, could I pick them up next week? Of course. Now, that'd be $1 a piece. Wonderful. Let's do that. So I got beautiful, full-color photographs of all of the papyri fragments, and as far as I knew at the time, and I believe this is true, I was the first non-member to ever do that. So I then got in touch with some other people, and the wonderful man named Wesley P. Walters, who was operating a ministry where was Wesley from? Illinois. Yes, he was Illinois. He worked with these photographs with me. We digitalized them by computer, that was in the very early days of doing that, and we were able to get all of them in the same scale, and then I assembled these where they'd been cut apart using the drawings on the back plus the text on the front to show what they looked like before they were cut apart. Now, this became the fold-out in By His Own Hand upon papyrus that even the Mormons love. You know, they are fascinated by that until they find out what it is. But their own church had never done anything like that. There was no reason for them to, especially to go and put facsimile one next to the Sensen text that is described in the alphabet and grammar, and of course you all know the story about that. So we came up with these wonderful illustrations to be able to use in the book. It took about, 5 or 6 years to actually get the book ready for publication. And in the meantime, I'd circulated a number of draft copies of the book printed on red paper so they couldn't be reproduced and so forth. And of course, some of those had found their ways into the hands of the church, and there were some critics at that time trying to go and create responses for it. This was about the time that I went back to BYU to complete my degree. Well, that was an interesting experience. We had a young man here that spoke last night. I think his name was Matt, who was a BYU student. Are you here, Matt? Hi, Matt. I'm the reason you had to leave BYU. Okay. You're welcome. I re-entered BYU as a non-member, and they had to take me. Okay. I was going there under vocational rehab because I had left my job at the prison, and so I was fully entitled to do it. In fact, I went there on a scholarship as a non-member. And the funniest darn thing, the registration form would go and say tuition, non-member, and give the amount, and then down below under personal information it had marriage, and it says Temple. And I remember being called into the standards office about halfway through my first semester back there. I was getting my teaching degree and so forth. Halfway through my first semester back there, I was called into the standards office, and they'd brought up the issue of this manuscript for the book that I was writing about the Book of Abraham. And they tried to make it seem as though this were some type of a standards violation. And I maintained that it was not, and that I would be happy to answer anyone who wanted to make that type of a charge, but I felt that it was not. And then the strangest thing, they asked me to just not publish it while I was still a student. Well, I was so far from publishing at that time that it was an easy guarantee to give them reluctantly. So I told them I would not publish it while I was still a student. I graduated with my degree and so forth, the major in history, the minor in anthropology, with the emphasis on archaeology, and my teaching certificate in 1990. And the book was actually published in 1990, I believe it was 92 or 93. And so I did keep my promise to them. But immediately after I left, they changed the rule that a person could no longer be a former Mormon and apply as a former Mormon to BYU, and that if any person at BYU who was a member of the church wanted to leave the church, that they would have to leave BYU. So, Matt, that's what happened. I thought that was curious. At the time, I was involved with a case with a young lady at the time, too, who had contacted my wife and I, who was a student at BYU, and wanted to leave. And she became basically the test case for this, and they used my experience to go and explain that it was an honor code violation for her to leave the church because she would be forsaking the covenants that she had made at baptism if she left the church. Therefore, she was violating the honor code. And I remember attending a hearing with that committee on her behalf, and I stood and I raised the question, well, what about people of other denominations who are encouraged and proselytized to join the LDS Church while they are at BYU? Would they not be forsaking the covenants that they had made to their own denomination? You want to hear what they said? They said that that was a matter of more truth versus less truth. Well, anyway, that's all neither here nor there. So I published By His Own Hand Upon Papyrus. It was published by the Institute for Religious Research in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And I don't want to go ahead and pull a Jeffrey Holland here, but I would say that after all these years, it still stands. In fact, over the last, it's been almost 18, 20 years almost, the criticisms and the responses that have come from the LDS Church have all been so flaky, and none of them have differed from the half dozen or so reactions and responses that I identified in the book originally. I find that remarkable, and I don't take any credit for that. It seemed so obvious at the time because it was obvious, and it still is. They have not come up with any new answers. Either, well, we have the wrong thing, or else there was another key to it, or else he didn't need it at all and it was direct revelation, whatever. They've got nothing new. And so I don't even bother responding to it anymore. One thing, though, that I was very concerned about as I published this book was I did not want it to be perceived as an anti-Mormon book. Now, my definition of anti-Mormon is someone who harbors a resentment and a unwarranted prejudice toward the Mormon people. Okay, that is an anti-Mormon. A critic of Mormonism is not an anti-Mormon, in my mind. Okay, now, and I think that most of you would agree with that. So one thing that I wanted to make sure was that no Latter-day Saint was ever able to say that I had written something critical of the LDS Church for money, because that was the only motive they could understand, either evil or money, okay? And since I wasn't having Hell's Angels park on my lawn, it would have to be money, right? I've not really discussed this before with other groups, never really brought it out, but I think that it's time to. Folks, this book has gone through nearly 40,000 editions, several printings. I have never received so much as a dime in royalties for it. Every cent that I was entitled to from the publisher has been diverted right back to the publisher in order to help fund making this book available to Mormons who ask for it free of cost. The publisher also has forfeited any profits from it to do the same thing. Every edition of this book that is sold in a bookstore helps fund 4 copies of it going out to Mormons who ask for it from the publisher. The publisher has sent me a case of those books to be able to make available to more people here. If you know a Mormon that you want to give one for, I ask you to make a donation to it. That donation will go directly to the Institute for Religious Research and help provide even more books for Mormons, okay? So see me. I have them in my room. That's the commercial. And interestingly, all of what I've just told you is just background now for my message today. Okay. My message, the theme is Overcoming the Anti-Mormon Label, One Writer's 20-Year Odyssey. It began, of course, with By His Own Hand Upon Papyrus, which was immediately attacked because who the heck is this young squirt fresh out of BYU think he's doing writing a book that challenges people like Joseph Smith and Hugh Nibley? Where are your credentials? Where is your degree in Egyptology? Where is this? Where is that? Where is the other thing? And the ad hominem attacks that we endured were incredible. My photograph for years was in the security office of the church security in the church office building. I had a beard then, looked pretty good. But I don't know if they have an updated one or not. They probably do. I don't know. But it was necessary, I think, to try to gain some type of credibility as a scholar before producing this type of a book if it was going to be taken seriously by the LDS. But by the same token, would it ever be taken seriously by the LDS? I don't think so. So I'm not sorry that I wrote it when I wrote it, but I did want to go and, for my own sake and for my family, try to go ahead and justify some sense of scholarship afterward, after the fact. So my odyssey at that point became trying to overcome this anti-Mormon label by giving credibility to myself as a scholar, as a historian, and as a writer. And that's what I want to talk about today. Now, do we have a timekeeper? Buzz me? How am I doing? Oh, I do? Oh, wonderful, then. Let's get into this. All right. Okay, this coffee's cold, so I'm going to go put it down. The problem with middle age is that the coffee goes right through you before it has a chance to do much good. One of the criticisms that John Gee made of my work when he was looking at my restoration of facsimile 1 was that I included in there an artist's restoration of what facsimile number 1 would look like based upon the condition of it and based upon other similar funerary texts and so forth. And of course we had the impregnation of Osiris, of Isis by Osiris and so forth on the embalming table after he was, reconstructed and so forth and was being prepared by Anubis. Oh, he hated that, and he had this criticism of it, that criticism of it, and everything. But one that really stuck in my craw was where John Gee said that this is an artist's reconception, or it's represented as an artist's reconstruction, and Charles Larson is not an artist. Charles Larson is an artist. Okay, I've been an artist for many, many years. I'm a professional engraver of firearms. I'm a metalsmith, a coinsmith. And one of the things that I am most known for, I used to have a website up. I'm not sure if it's up now or not. I think it needs maintenance because it was being hijacked by China to send pornography, so I took it down. But it was called coinsmith.com. And on my website, I give examples of the types of coins and so forth that I recreated. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me start out by saying that as an artist, I undertook a project to study the Deseret Mint. Now, have any of you heard of the Deseret Mint? Okay, this was the early venture of the LDS Church after they just arrived in the Valley to establish some type of a monetary system. Okay, at least that's what everyone had always thought that it was, and they produced some gold coins at the time. I decided to study the Deseret Mint and make quite a historical study of it, and basically, when I published this paper, Recreating the Deseret Mint, a Contemporary Study of Pioneer Coin-Making Methods, this was delivered before the American Numismatic Association's annual convention in Salt Lake City on March 10, 2001. It basically means that I own that part of Mormon history. I discovered everything that could be discovered about the mint, and I studied the original dies, the original die tools, and I recreated the early Mormon coinage by hand in order to study how much effort was required to make those coins, to make the dies, to make the equipment to make it, what level of skill, how hard it was. And so I produced these museum quality sets of the hand-struck Mormon coins of 1849. The LDS Church actually carries these as collector sets in the Museum of History and Art just across from Temple Square to the west. Okay, they're not the little tokens that are made in Taiwan or whatever that you can find in little visitor centers all over the place. These are actually hand-struck on a gravity hammer the same way as the originals were, from the hand-cut dies, with every minute little imperfection that the originals had. So I own that part of Mormon history. I used that then to write my next book, which has a Mormon theme only because of the Mormon coins that were used to help describe it. And that book is Numismatic Forgery, an illustrated, annotated guide to the practical principles, methods, and techniques employed in the private manufacture of rare coins. Scary book. Received some wonderful reviews, by the way. It won the Best World Coin Book Award at the ANA Convention in Pittsburgh in 2004. And it became an instant bestseller. It describes various methods that forgers and counterfeiters use to make rare coins. And, of course, I employed the same methods in making my Mormon coins. So that gave me a kind of a credibility as a scholar and as an artist, but from a rather dubious standpoint here. I should tell you that the study of coins has always been an important part of history, and of course the mechanics of it had fascinated to me and was fascinating to me. And so as I would study coins, I would study how they were made and how they might be created by forgers. I was very fortunate in those early days when I worked at the state prison because I was Mark Hoffman's prison guard. One of the aspects of my job... Oh, thank you. Wow. I get a thing to hold it. Cool. You're so good. Okay. Yeah, okay, good. One of the aspects of my job was to let Mark out of his cell at night so he could do chairman duties, so he could go and sweep the floor, make the coffee for the next morning, and then come into my office and BS for a couple of hours. Now, Mark was a fascinating person. He was intellectually starved at the prison. He was trying to learn Latin, so I would take him into the office, and we'd go ahead and conjugate Latin verbs and so forth. He was trying to join Mensa, so I sponsored him. But I actually was able to get over 50 hours of exclusive interview with Mark Hoffman that no one else ever got because he didn't realize he was being interviewed. I found out who the third bomb was supposed to be for, or what it was supposed to be for. It was to blow up his car, folks. He was trying to go ahead and give himself an excuse to go into hiding so that he wouldn't have to go ahead and produce the documents that he had pre-burned and placed in his car. That was the whole reason that the car blew up. Unfortunately, he had parked it outside the Deseret Gym, where the assembly hall now stands, on the slope of a hill, and so the bomb, as it sat on the floor of his car, and he went to go and pull the paper out that would go ahead and arm it. Well, it was on a slope, and so the mercury switch had already closed contact, and he pulled the paper out, and it blew up right in his face, and he didn't expect that to happen. But anyway, that was neither here nor there. We talked a lot about coin forgery because I was doing much of the research that I would later use in this book at the time. I showed him some dies that I had cut, and he admired them and told me that he wished he'd known me on the street. And he taught me a few of the techniques that he used to make counterfeit coins as well, because that was what he began his forgery with, was forging coins. So I described some of his techniques in that book as well, and it's the first time that they've been discussed. In fact, it broke the mystery of a very rare coin that had come up in the world here just around 2002, and that was a 1959 penny that had a 1958 reverse to it. That was the year that they put the memorial on the back. There's only one example of it known, and it appeared mysteriously in 1986. And Mark later claimed to have made that coin, but no one could figure out how he could have made it because it was perfect. Well, he had described to me some years earlier the method that he used to create die shells by electroplating nickel onto a coin and popping it off. And I described that in my book. And the president of the American Numismatic Association was astounded. So I replicated that I scientifically replicated that process using the same equipment that Mark Hoffman had. I inherited his plating machine from one of his victims. And so I reproduced that 1959 scent with a 1958 back, and a couple of years ago I presented it to the ANA Museum in Colorado Springs. So it described the method then that Mark had used to do that. So I notched myself up now as a researcher, okay, and as a scientist, all because of numismatic forgery. Well, I then felt that I had enough wind under my sails to be able to really do some serious writing. And so I decided that I would take all of the experiences that I had collected and try to go and describe Mormon culture in a way that would be readable, not to people that had any interest at all in Mormonism. In other words, to the average person worldwide who may or may not know a Mormon, may or may not have heard anything about a Mormon, but they're still interesting people, aren't they? And it's an interesting culture, isn't it? So I wrote my third book, Destroying Angel, which was released a year ago. Okay. I'd like to talk a little bit about Destroying Angel. Destroying Angel is a novel set in contemporary Utah. It centers around a series of home intrusions and killings that are taking place. In the opening chapters, an entire family is taken in their sleep into the garage and hanged. And the message on the wall is, for and on the behalf of Dudley Levitt, who is dead. When this is discovered, it really sends ripples through Utah, as you might imagine that it would if it were real. They are looking for some type of a motive, and all they have is the name for and on the behalf of Dudley Levitt, who is dead. They know that the former governor's name was Michael Levitt, and they discover that Dudley Levitt was a pioneer ancestor of Michael Levitt, and that he was also a pioneer ancestor of the woman in the household whose family was all killed, although distant relation. Very unlikely that they'd known each other. Did I wear the battery out on that already? Okay. So immediately they imagine that there must be someone trying to intimidate the governor of the state of Utah by killing a distant family related to him, a family distantly related to him. And so they try to figure out what the motive for that could be, and the only thing they can come up with is that it must be fundamentalist Mormons because Michael Levitt was responsible for initiating a crackdown against them late in his term that before they'd been ignored for nearly 70 years while Utah pretended they didn't exist. So this had to be it, and so naturally this would become an instance of domestic terrorism, so Homeland Security is called in. This sets up the role of all of my main characters, by the way. I have the Attorney General's office, who has a close society investigator known as the Polygamy Czar. This is real. This is real. I've known the Polygamy Czar, okay? They really have that. Okay, but in my book, this fellow is a Jack Mormon who was born and raised in Utah and so forth, an old Vietnam vet, and he teams up with a Gentile from Homeland Security who knows nothing about Mormonism, and the Gentile has to learn everything he can about the fundamentalists and why they are the way that they are. So I use the book there as a vehicle to describe contemporary fundamentalist Mormonism and their relationship with the Orthodox Mormon Church, which most people are blissfully unaware of, including Mormons. And so it becomes a fascinating study there. Well, as they get into it, there are other killings as well. An entire family in St. George this time, for and on the behalf of William Dame. So they're trying to scramble. Again, William Dame was a pioneer that was related, you know, was an ancestor of the family. But they cannot determine who William Dame's descendant that might be trying to be intimidated was. It wasn't related to Michael Levitt. So they go through all the genealogy, the 10,000 descendants of William Dame, and they aren't able to determine that. Then finally another killing up in Logan, clear on the other end of the state, an entire family, for and on the behalf of Isaac Haight, who is dead.
And then they realized that there was an apostle named David B. Haight. And again, this Isaac Haight was an ancestor of David B. Haight and also the family that was killed. So they're trying to, the investigators are trying to, I can see I've got a couple of you really, huh? The investigators are trying to interview David B. Haight, and they aren't able to get to him because he's in his 90s and about to die, and so they have to interview a grandson in the church historian's office. And this is when they realize that David B. Haight's ancestor, Isaac Haight, and William Dame and Dudley Levitt all had one thing in common as pioneers. They were participants in the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And so someone was tracking down the descended families of the perpetrators of the Mountain Meadows Massacre who had never been punished and is executing their families, their descended families, by proxy as executions to punish the original perpetrators. That's where the book goes. What a plot. Exactly. And since the book came out, it's been fairly well received. It's gotten some marvelous reviews. It's very readable. I encourage all of you to read it. Sue, you've read it. Sue read it. It's great, she said. Okay.
It's great.
My publisher has sent a couple of boxes of those books here, too. So I'm able to give them to you at a great discount. He's allowing me to give you a $15 for the hardcover. It's normally $30, and $10 for the paperback. It's normally $18 or whatever. So yeah, I'll be happy to sign those for you. Come see me in my room. I have about two or three copies of Numismatic Forgery, and that's the end of the commercial. Let me just talk a little bit about the fundamentalists and about Mountain Meadows, if I can. For several years, I worked with the Attorney General's office as a volunteer on what's called the Safety Net Committee. This was a group, it still is a group, that is put together in order to try to help the members of these fundamentalist groups come out of from behind their walls and integrate into society, trust government agencies, and a lot of that has to do with being able to apply for services and assistance if they need it. It provides help to the women if they're leaving the situation. It addresses things like spousal abuse, child abuse, and so forth, and family living skills. And it's actually been very well received. The communities down in Colorado City and Hilldale have been the most resistant to it, but just down the road from them in Centennial Park, where you have the liberal fundamentalists, they are very receptive to it. We've made huge inroads with the Apostolic United Brethren group. They've agreed to no longer perform or condone underage marriages. Even the Kingston group has begun coming aboard with it, the Davis County Co-op. So most of the major groups and many of the independents and so forth are all feeling benefit from the work of the Safety Net Committee, and I helped to have some input into that in working with those communities. I have a pretty good handle on where the fundamentalists are in their head, the fundamentalist Mormons, and explaining their lifestyle in my book, which I'm able to do, was a lot of fun. I have had fundamentalists read this book, and they've loved it too, because it actually, they feel it gives a fair view of what their lifestyle is supposed to be like and what they're capable of making it. Now, you remember when I told you about my wife, that was the one button that she didn't like, the fundamentalism, the polygamy? Don't blame her. And I am not an aspiring fundamentalist. I am not a desirous polygamist. I would never want to live that type of a lifestyle. But I guess the libertarian in me says that I don't mind people that do, if that works for them, as long as they're not abusing someone, as long as they're all consenting adults. So I'll tell you up front that that's basically the tack that I take in the book, and that's the tack that I'm trying to teach the rest of the world to view them as. If that's what they want to do and they like it, let them do it. But for heaven's sake, leave the little girls alone, okay? Well, anyway. Mountain Meadows. Okay. Mountain Meadows is a huge theme in Destroying Angel, because once they start discovering the threads of the ancestors being related to these original crimes, now my Gentile investigator has got to go and learn about Mountain Meadows. So through a series of flashbacks, I bring Mountain Meadows to life on the last day. Now, Mountain Meadows has been written about many, many times all over the place, and even the Mormon Church has now come out with their apologetics on it, based upon exhaustive research and motive. My depiction of the last day of Mountain Meadows has been described by people like Will Bagley and Wayne Capurro as the most accurate, dramatic depiction that has been written. And I take great pride and comfort in that. On the 150th anniversary of Mountain Meadows, on September 11th, 2007, the Mountain Meadows Monument Foundation, the Mountain Meadows Descendants Group, met in Cedar City, Utah, to commemorate the event, and I appeared at that. And at that time, Destroying Angel was nearing publication date. We took all of the excerpts, all of the flashbacks from the sequences which are interspersed within the chapters of Destroying Angel, and we assembled them together in one little booklet, a little novella, called A Retrospective on the Mountain Meadows Massacre, excerpts from the novel Destroying Angel. We printed 500 of these books, and we made them available free of charge to the descendants of the Mountain Meadows Massacre's families only. That's the only place that this book ever went. I'm giving one of these, that I have about three of them, I'm giving one of them for as a door prize for this group tonight. So that's the only way you will ever be able to get one, is if you're a descendant of the Mountain Meadows Massacre victims, or if you receive one here. But that is the dramatic description of it. It was a heartbreaking thing to write, to realize what people can do to people. And, you know, getting inside of the Mormon's head at the time, I've seen some total garbage that's been written about what happened, and some very inflammatory stuff and some very apologetic stuff. Getting inside the Mormon's head at the time, it's almost hard to believe what they did, but it's almost hard to believe that they could have done anything else. That was the way that they were conditioned. It was what they believed, and it was so totally wrong, but the entire system at that time was so totally wrong. These people were totally isolated out where they were. They were willing to believe that the world was coming to an end, that they were about to usher in the new millennium, and that Armageddon was upon them. And it was this sense of paranoia, this religious zealotry, this fanaticism that drove them to go and justify the massacring of entire families. So all of that is described in there. Well, as Destroying Angel winds down, though, it turns out that Mountain Meadows was not the reason at all, and that was another red herring that the killer was using, and I'm not going to tell you what the real killer was up to. So I'll leave that to you to read. Anyway, the book is available for you. This basically then is the story of how I have tried, at least in my 20-year writing career, to produce something that could be useful to people, to fill a need that I felt myself. I wish that By His Own Hand of Papyrus had been available when I was looking around. And then I wouldn't have had to spend a week reading Shadow or Reality, but you know, I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did. Moving on from there to establish credentials that even the Mormon Church can respect as an artist, as a historian, and then to go on and to be a credible anthropologist, if you will, in describing a culture in terms that are neither condemning nor flattering. It's a story that I hope to continue. I hope to write more books. I'm about 2 years away from retiring from the state, and then I'll just write full-time. And, of course, then they'll make a movie and cast Kevin Costner in it, and we'll do all of that. We have a bit of time left here, and I want to turn that back over to you. And I'd love to go ahead and hear some of your questions and try to answer them if I can. So,
what are we doing with Mike?
We probably want to do a mic. That would be great. Okay. Again, I've had so many people come up to me since I've been here and thank me for my book. You don't know what that does to us when you do that. I just want to say it was a privilege to give it to you if it helped you. And if it helps anyone, it's a privilege. So thank you. Thank you.
Would you please discuss Hugh Nibley's defense of the Book of Abraham?
Okay.
Okay.
The question was, would I please discuss Hugh Nibley's response to the Book of Abraham? The French have a word, merde, similar to the Spanish word, mierda, similar to the English word, crap. Hugh Nibley, you know, nobody wanted to criticize Hugh Nibley during his life, even the people who disagreed with him, because he seemed like this pleasant little man who was just, you know, like a Mr. Cheever type of guy. Mormons are just in awe about him because he's a defender of the faith, and all of them wish they could be defenders of the faith, but they don't have to bother themselves by looking at things because there already are people like Hugh Nibley. So why do that? I once raised great offense with a Mormon by telling them what I thought of Hugh Nibley. And so I'll share that with you too. Hugh Nibley is a prostitute. Hugh Nibley is someone who took the gifts and the education and the intellect and the scholarship that he had, all of those skills, and he prostitutes them. Prostituted before he died. He will assume any position, regardless of how degrading or irrelevant, in order to satisfy his client. Isn't that a prostitute? His explanations were solely based upon convenience or expediency or what he felt he could get away with getting the most people to go on board with. And today, his work is largely perpetuated by farms. Almost everyone who writes with farms, including John Gee, their golden-haired boy, is basically a Hugh Nibley disciple, and all they do is rehash Hugh Nibley's old crap. I'll tell you an interesting story. When I was at BYU the second time as a non-member, and I was in the anthropology department studying archaeology, in the anthropology department at BYU, there is an underground organization known as Ranches. Okay. It stands for R-A-N-C-H-S. It's meant to be a counterfoil to farms. And it stands for real archaeology, not crazy hysterical shit. That is how the scientists at even BYU view Hugh Nibley. Okay. All right. Is there another question? Okay.
It seemed that I read somewhere that when this Book of Abraham thing started busting loose, that Hugh Brown wanted to drop it from the canon. Do you know if that's true, or is that just secondary hearsay stuff?
I've never heard that. The Book of Abraham is integral to the LDS faith to the point where now they are, and even then, they had come to the conclusion that, well, it didn't matter where it came from, it's what's in it that counts. Okay, so, you know, we trust Joseph Smith because he's never lied to us before, so this must be true. So no, I've never heard that. I knew that the reorganized church never adopted the Book of Abraham into its canon, and so they never got into things like Kolob and eternal progression. When you realize that the Book of Abraham was an incomplete work, that Joseph Smith still had lots of papyri that he'd never pretended to, or got around to pretending to translate, you wonder where he was going with it. He'd started it in Kirtland, of course, and then he'd picked it back up in Nauvoo in 1842. Had he not been killed, he probably would have continued with it and used it to go and justify his introduction of polygamy. So I suspect that was where the Book of Abraham was going. But of course, it ended beforehand. He certainly foreshadowed a lot of it, though, in the other things that he was doing at the time. So the Book of Abraham, the Utah Church was very correct in believing that Joseph Smith wanted to use the Book of Abraham to introduce these new doctrines that were creeping into the church that he was coming up with to satisfy his libido. Okay. Yes, sir.
I heard your presentation at the conference in Las Vegas in 1998. And at that time, I recall you told a story about how you lost your teaching job in a public school because of the publication of that book. Can you summarize that for us again?
Well, gosh, I try to forget that. Yes, I had gone back to BYU in order, as I said, to complete my degree, since I'd interrupted my education to get married and raise a family, to complete my degree and to get a teaching certificate. And once I graduated from BYU, I began working in the Provo School District. A couple of years later, By His Own Hand Upon Papyrus was published, again with the agreement from the author that royalty funds and so forth would go back into providing copies of the book. When that book was published, about 25,000 copies of it, the publisher was an amazing fellow. His name is Roger Hansen. I'm still in contact with him. He had raised donations from people to be able to go and fund the first printing of the book and to provide 25,000 copies of it to lists of Mormons that people provided to their addresses. So basically that book was dropped like a bomb on the LDS community almost immediately and overnight. One of those books found its way into the home of the husband of one of the teachers at the school where I was teaching in the Provo School District. He was a seminary teacher, and he was livid about it. So he showed it to his wife. The wife recognized the name, took it to the school, showed it to the principal. And for the next 12 months, I found myself inexplicably meeting obstacles in my teaching. All of a sudden, books weren't available for me to teach history from. A classroom was not available. I remember one time teaching out of a broom closet in the new school because the classroom wasn't available. Schedules were changed, hours were cut, all kinds of things. I went through just enormously weird things. And I found out much later on that the principal, the good bishop and so forth, had issued instructions to find an excuse to evaluate me in order to justify my termination. I had teachers at the back of my room, you know, administrators evaluating me almost every other class I taught. And they couldn't come up with anything. They couldn't. I mean, the students loved me. They loved my classes. They loved the getting into things. I changed a lot of lives then during that period of my life. So what they did was they finally called me in at the end of the school year, and they said, your position's being eliminated through a reduction in force by. So I left. And then found out that they immediately hired another new young BYU graduate to fill my place. So I got in touch with the Labor Commission, and I filed a complaint, and this ended up being forwarded all the way up to the Department of Justice, where they came back and ruled that the school district had engaged in egregious discrimination on the basis of my religious beliefs and practices. And the school district, of course, kept denying that, and they wanted it to go all the way to court. They got their attorneys. The ACLU got involved on my behalf. I had good representation and so forth. What it finally boiled down to, the school district started making settlement offers, very minor ones. Okay, I mean, this was no, oh, I'm going to get $1 million and retire type thing. Nothing like that. I eventually barely settled for about a third of a year's salary and no reinstatement. Well, the principal went on to get a promotion and on this other kinds of stuff because they'd covered themselves. What it finally came down to was we were told by the attorneys from the state, the risk management people, that if this went to trial, No one in the state of Utah would want to go and penalize a school district and take money out of the children who needed it. And I would be seen as the greedy, avaricious apostate to the people on the jury who were likely to be some sheep farmer from Mona. So we decided to accept the settlement. Again, it was very, very minor. And that was how I left teaching. An interesting side note to that. About a year ago, I was walking downtown Provo, and a man passed me, and he stopped, and he said, "You're Charles Larson, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes." And he introduced himself. He was the attorney for the school district at the time with the risk management. And that man stood there, shook my hand, and apologized to me for doing what he had to do at the time because the school district was his client. He was no longer working for the state, and he was in private practice, but he wanted me to know that he deeply regretted having to take the position that he did. And I just thanked him. So that was, yes, I remember that very well.
We know that Joseph Smith's sources for the Book of Mormon were something like the view of the Hebrews and the Spalding manuscript and perhaps Oliver Cowdery and Sidney Rigdon. In your opinion, what sort of sources could Joseph Smith have used to write the Book of Abraham?
Oh, I'm glad you asked me that. I haven't written a book on this, but I have developed this theme, and I hope eventually to go and do that. I believe, and again, this is based on whatever research has been available, I believe that view of the Hebrews had a profound impact upon Joseph Smith's writing of the Book of Mormon. Now, I understand there's going to be another presenter here talking about that. Who is that? Oh, I'm looking forward to that a lot because I want to see how much my theory meshes. And I'll tell you my theory, and then you can go ahead and compare it too, okay? View of the Hebrews was written by Ethan Smith, a pastor of the Congregational Church in Pulteney, Vermont. Oliver Cowdery's mother was a member of that congregation. Oliver Cowdery attended that church, listened to Ethan Smith's sermon. Ethan Smith's obsession and hobby, if you will, was the idea that the American Indians were Israelites, that they were the 10 lost tribes or something like that. Of course, many other people at the time believed that as well. Elidus Boudinot, The Star in the West, and a number of other books going back for, clear on back to Cotton Mather. Okay. So Ethan Smith was not alone in this false anthropological, proto-anthropological assumption of the early 19th century that the Indians were Hebrews. But he wrote about it extensively and eventually compiled his writings into a little book in 1823 called A View of the Hebrews, or The Tribes of Israel in America. He then expanded that book in 1825 to include huge portions of Isaiah that were meant to go and show that the prophecies of Isaiah were being fulfilled. If the Indians could only be proselytized and brought to Christianity, it would hasten the millennium. Sound familiar? Okay, so anyway, you have Oliver Cowdery attending this man's church because his mother was a member. In 1825, the same year that the second edition of View of the Hebrews was published, Oliver Cowdery went to upstate New York to teach, okay, and he later found himself boarding in the Smith home. Now, I'm trying to recall the exact relationship here, but Oliver Cowdery's great aunt was Lucy Mack Smith's grandmother, or something of that nature, okay. Wes Walters had uncovered that family relationship, and I believe, it is my belief that in 1827 or 8, whenever this was, that he was boarding in the Smith's home, that he discovered this relationship with the Smith family as the Smith family was telling him about this wonderful project that their son down in Harmony was, Harmony, Pennsylvania, was writing. Okay. This was at the time that Martin Harris had taken the 116 pages of the Book of Lehi up there to go ahead and show to his wife, and the manuscript disappeared, and of course Joseph Smith was livid and dejected and was in a severe state of depression. Okay, this is simultaneous with Oliver Cowdery being in the Smith home, being told about this work and so forth. I believe And it's my theory that Oliver Cowdery recognized the theme from what was described to him of this lost book of Lehi as being the theme of view of the Hebrews. And that being a relation now of the family, it was his intent then the following spring to accompany Samuel Smith down to Harmony to meet Joseph Smith and to resurrect this project, and that through Oliver Cowdery's assistance and familiarity with view of the Hebrews and identification as a relative, that he basically collaborated with Joseph Smith on expanding the book of Lehi, finding an excuse to write the same story but not in the same words, and produce the Book of Mormon. And that's my theory. Oliver Cowdery then brought other friends of his, including the entire David Whitmer family, into this. He married David Whitmer's sister, and later on in Missouri, when so many of the persecutions began raining down upon the Latter-day Saints and Whitmer's suffered terribly, Oliver Cowdery was in no position to go and say, wait a minute, this whole thing, we just made it up. He could not have done that. All he could do was separate himself from the people, and even years later, he would never not defend that for the sake of the family people that, you know, his own family that he'd married into, some of whom lost their lives. So I think Oliver Cowdery was a very unhappy man with what he had done, but I see the entire Mormon experience as something that got away from both him and Joseph Smith and was moving faster than any of them could keep up with. When you start thinking of Oliver Cowdery not as a dupe, but as a participant in this whole creation of it, then a lot of other things make sense too. How about the testimony of the three witnesses? Oliver Cowdery, David Whitmer, and Martin Harris. When you read the account of how the first vision took place, Oliver and David and Martin and Joseph all go out in the woods to pray for a vision and nothing happens. Martin Harris gets all discouraged and says, it's my sin that's causing this, you know, after all, I'm the guy that lost part of the book, you know. So he withdraws and goes and has his little manic depressive episode. Meanwhile, you have David Whitmer, Joseph Smith, and Oliver Cowdery. Joseph Smith and Oliver Cowdery immediately begin describing and corroborating each other's vision that they are having. And poor David is sitting there, too afraid to admit that he doesn't see anything. Oh, yeah, that really is a white robe. What'd you say? Yeah. So you have David Whitmer on board at that point. Then they all go on back there, and Oliver Cowdery drafts up the statement for everybody to sign, but on the way back, of course, they come across Martin Harris. So David and Oliver go on ahead to the house to finish drafting the statement. Joseph sits down with Martin and, you know, prays with him a little bit and commiserates with him, and then all of a sudden, oh my gosh, Martin, look, there's the same vision again occurring, you know. And this time, poor Martin, what's he going to say? Human psychology. You place these things, the way that people act, into historical events, and you can understand the historical event. And all of a sudden, you've got three sober people testifying that they saw an angel with plates. Right? So I believe that Oliver Cowdery was a collaborator, and that's my theory. Others are certainly free to interpret history their own way, too. Okay. Anything else here? Gosh. Oh, okay, there's one in the back. Could you come up to the microphone?
I don't know. Can you hear me from here?
I can hear you, but I think they're recording these, dear, so if you'd come up, please. Yeah.
I'm just curious. You just seem so resilient. I find it fascinating that you still place yourself in Utah County. You go to BYU after being a member now. I'm just curious where that comes from. Is it a desire to disprove? Is it that your family's just there and so you're going to just make do? Or how? I'm curious about that.
Well, if you look up the word masochism in the dictionary, after discovering what Mormonism really was, I wanted to leave Utah so bad. I'd come here to be part of Mormonism, and then I just wanted to be part of the normal world again. Being normal, the idea of being normal meant everything to me. Now, of course, as I mentioned at the beginning here, and as all of you know, everyone here has a different destination that they've either arrived at or that they're en route to. My destination is a spiritual one, okay? I'm a Christian man. I have faith in God, and that gives me comfort. That's what my identity is. And, you know, I'm tolerant of anyone else. I'm even tolerant of Mormon views for Mormons, you know, if they want to be. But if they want to know more, I'm willing to speak with them. I feel that God wants me where I'm at. After many years of struggling against that, I've come to accept the wise counsel of an old man writing from prison near the end of his life. When Paul said, "Therein I have learned to be content that whatsoever state I am in." And so I'm perfectly happy where I'm at, and that's where I'm going to be.
I just wondered if you could talk about where this idea of blood atonement first came into the religion. And also the comment you made about live and let live. I used to have that feeling, and now I see so many of the families that are in the fundamentalist Mormonism, and their children are almost like compelled to live that lifestyle. So I see a lot of problems there, and I'd just like you to address that as well.
Thank you. I'm glad that you asked that. Well, to start with the blood atonement is something that is really misunderstood by a lot of people. How many of you saw the film September Dawn? Do you remember that scene there where they're in the church and, terrible movie, they're in the church and they're deciding to go ahead with the massacre, and then everybody sits up and chants, "Blood atonement, blood atonement." Blood atonement has absolutely nothing to do with killing Gentiles. Blood atonement was a concept that was taught by Brigham Young and Jedediah Grant and others during the Reformation of the 1850s, which applied only to members of the church. Okay, if a member of the church did something that could not be atoned for through the regular repentance channels of the priesthood and service and all that other stuff, they committed one of these heinous acts, only the shedding of their own blood could justify them before God, and that they were expected to willingly submit to having their throat cut, their blood spill upon the ground, where the smoke thereof could arise as a holy incense to God, satisfying justice. The blood of Christ could not cover their sin. That was blood atonement. How could that apply to a Gentile or a non-member? The killing of someone else, well, it might be for some other reason, like to remove the stumbling block of mortality so that beyond the veil they could accept the gospel, but it wasn't blood atonement. Okay, so that was what blood atonement was. Many fundamentalists still believe a lot of the crap that Brigham Young introduced, that Joseph Smith introduced, that the Orthodox Church has since sanitized, washed away, or kept in the background. And there are fundamentalists who believe in blood atonement. The Lafferty brothers, for example, were absorbed in the idea of blood atonement. And when the wife of one of the brothers wouldn't allow him to go and join this movement, they went and killed the wife and the baby. That was how the Laffertys ended up in prison. But blood atonement is a horrid idea, thoroughly unchristian, but it's what happens when you go and put men in charge of something as significant as people's lives. So, okay, now on the second part of your question about the children in polygamy, yes, there are polygamous groups that are extremely isolated, that are extremely controlling. My own personal feeling is that the reason they are that way is because they have been underground for so long, hiding from society, hiding from the law, that if they make themselves invisible to the law cannot see them in order to be able to protect them. Okay, if these people did not have to hide from the law, then the law could do just that. They are able to exercise control. I'm speaking of the leaders of these fundamentalist sects and so forth, the ones that are very secretive, the ones that are very controlling, the things like Warren Jeffs and some that are even worse, believe it or not, are able to do that because the people, if they can't get protection from the law, they will seek protection from some other authority, even one that's willing to exploit them. Don't you see the same type of a thing with undocumented aliens in this country? They're supposed to be invisible before the law. They don't exist. Okay, so what do they do for their own protection? They get exploited by traffickers and human smuggling, by gangs, by all kinds of things, because they're looking for some group that they can have an identity with that will protect them. And the fundamentalists are the same way. I think much of that would be solved if their lifestyle could be at least decriminalized to the point where they don't have to fear the law, and then they could be protected. Oh, just one. All right.
Your manic depressive comment reminded me of a question I needed to ask. Were you privileged to listen to Elder Holland's talk on Sunday afternoon? It seems like he was under assignment to protect us from people like you. And how would you deconstruct his rant?
Is it working, by the way? Elder Holland, how can I put this kindly, has issues. Okay. I did not listen to his talk, no, but I caught the blurb of it on the news that evening, which every station planned. Now, let me see if I have this right. He is the one who talked about how this book, the Book of Mormon, has been assailed, has been challenged, it's been, you know, vilified. More has been written about it than any other book in the entire world against it. And yet it stands. Well, yeah, it does. It stands if you stick it up on a prop like that, okay? But, I mean, if you want to ignore all that has been written about it for the last 150 years, then and close your mind to everything else. The only reason the Book of Mormon stands is because it has so many unfortunate, exploited people propping it up. Anyone else who's looked at it, you answer that question yourselves. You're the best ones to answer it, okay? All right. Thank you very much.